Once the word leaves the human being, once the word leaves me, leaves my emotions, leaves my thoughts, it's significant. It's very significant. On the contrary, for the person outside of me, that's the only way through which he gets to know me, through my words. I communicate to him my thoughts, I communicate to him my feelings, I communicate to him my ideas. Without these words, he would know nothing about me. That's relative to the person outside of me. But what about for me, myself? Within me and for me, the words add nothing and take away nothing. Theoretically speaking, if I were to live in a cocoon, if I were to live alone, and no other person would be existing, it's obvious that words would not add anything. The whole content, the whole quality, the virtue of words only begins as something outside of me. As something which exists within me, I don't need it. It adds nothing. It's meaningless and it's irrelevant. When I'm feeling a feeling, the words that define that feeling have no worth, they have no value, they're not needed. A teacher, take a teacher who's teaching a piece of Gemara to 13-year-old boys. The teacher has to, if he's a good teacher, he has to toil and work hard to find the words, the expressions that are appropriate in order to explain to these 13-year-olds this piece of Gemara. He has to find the right explanations, the appropriate parables, and metaphors, analogies, the right words that they should be able to comprehend this profound Talmudic idea. Now everybody understands that all these words that he's using in order to articulate the idea, in order to convey it, existed before he started to give the class. They were all there, but he did not sense them. He wasn't even aware of them. Why? Because they don't have an independent reality. They're part of the logic. They're absorbed. They're nullified. They're drowned in the identity of the logic itself. They don't add anything. And when he understands the logic, so he doesn't need them. They don't have a name. They don't have an identity. They don't have a value when they're in the presence of their source, of the logic itself. When the Havana of the Svara, when the person is in touch with the very understanding of the idea, there's no need for them. They don't play any role because their whole purpose is just to express the idea, to bring it to a place where this idea is not readily understood and comprehended. And that's why in the very place of the idea, they're meaningless. So the 13-year-old children who need all of these words and all of these parables, for them it becomes extremely significant. But in the world of the teacher itself, before he gave the class, even though all these words were there, but they were meaningless, they were irrelevant, they didn't add anything, he didn't need them, because he understood the very substance of the idea. He didn't need all the various words through which he articulates it to the children. And that's the whole concept of Isis. Isis, like we discussed last week, Isis means letters, words. Chassidus explains comes from the word in Tanakh, Asa Boiker, the morning arrived. Isis letters are communication tools. They allow an image or an experience to travel to a distant place. And in the presence of the experience itself, whether it's awareness or emotions, they have no identity. Their identity begins in so far as they are existing in a space that's devoid of the experience. Their purpose is to allow the experience to travel, to arrive to a place where it doesn't exist. But in the original place of the experience, there's no need for them. Now, this was all in chapter 20, and we discussed it at length last week with all the details and the metaphors and the parables that I gave last week in order to convey the idea. Now the Alter Rebbe comes along in chapter 21 and says the following: Since leis hasar ponemineh, since there's no place that's devoid of Hashem's existence, so this single word of Hashem that created and creates all of the worlds never departed from His inner self, because there's no space devoid of Him. So the word that's creating the universes is still absorbed and submerged within His intimate presence. So what does that mean? What does that tell us about reality? That means that if you look outside of the window right now, and the doors of your perception were transparent, you would see that the only true existing reality outside this window and in this room right now is the intimate reality of Hashem. Words assume a presence only outside of the emotion. In the presence of the emotion, they have no reality, they have no identity. We are all basically a word of Hashem. A word is a particular form of articulation. And when this particular form of articulation is existing within its source, it has no presence. And the only presence that one ought to talk about is the intimate presence, not the word. And now we come to the big question that was asked last week about the parable that Alter Rebbe employed at the conclusion of chapter 20. When he wanted to illustrate the point. You see, chapter 21 is a direct continuum to chapter 20. We cannot understand it without chapter 20. These two chapters are totally one unit. When Alter Rebbe wanted to illustrate the concept, the point, that in the presence of man's inner personality, letters and words have no identity, they're virtually non-existent, he explains it in the following words. What did he say? He said that within the emotional craving towards something, there are no letters and no words, just a simple craving. I crave something. Craving, he describes, is not made up of letters and words. Fine. As we explained last week, a person doesn't love in words, you don't love in English, and you don't feel anger in French. Certainly, the Alter Rebbe said, in the awareness that preceded the craving, there are no letters and no words. One does not understand in English or Persian. Awareness, understanding transcends words and letters. Aisyas, the Alter Rebbe said, are introduced only at a later stage. Following man's awareness of a truth, of a concept, of an item, of an article, of a human being, of an object, of a theme, whatever it is, following his awareness, he craves it. And then he thinks about how to implement his craving, and that's when Isis, that's when letters emerge. And the point Alter Rebbe wanted to say is, as it becomes clear in chapter 21, that one word or words in the presence of awareness or emotions are virtually non-existent, because the whole concept and dynamic of letters and words are meaningless, are irrelevant there. The fact that a person thinks in words and letters about an idea which he comprehended or a feeling that he felt is only stage two. That is the communication of the awareness or of the feeling. In order to communicate the feeling to himself or to other people, he needs words, he needs letters, whether they are letters of thought or letters of speech. But in the very experience of awareness or feelings, there's no need for letters or words. A feeling or an awareness is not made up from letters. Even if they exist, they're totally not felt. They don't have a presence. They don't assume a presence. Fine. But that's not what Alter Rebbe says. The Alter Rebbe says that letters are born and emerge only when you think how to implement your craving. And apparently that requires clarification. Can't a person think about his very emotion or his very awareness? Letters and words, thoughts are only born when I think about how to implement my craving? What about if I think about the very craving? The point of the Alter Rebbe is understood. What Alter Rebbe is saying is that in the presence of your intimate emotions, words don't play a role. They're meaningless. They're irrelevant. But Alter Rebbe says something very interesting. He says that words and letters emerge, they're brought into existence only when we think about how to implement a craving. How to implement it, not even about the craving itself. So, one of my Tanya teachers, Rabbi Yoel Kahn, suggested the following answer based on what is discussed in various other Chabad discourses. And this is how it goes. With this choice of word, it's possible that Alter Rebbe wants to convey to us a deeper element in understanding cosmic unity, in understanding the non-existence of existence. Because there are two types of words. There are words, there are letters, oisius, and letters and words that are containers. They contain the emotion. Say the following three words. I love you. I love you. True. In the presence of the emotion, these words are irrelevant. They may exist in some fashion, but in the presence of their source, they occupy no data. They have no presence. They possess no status. They're virtually non-existent. Only when they leave their intimate source, they assume identity, significance, eminence, etc. And since by Hashem, the word never leaves its intimate source, so it remains as though it's non-existent. True. But nevertheless, since these words are containers, are vehicles, are vessels that express the emotion, after all is said, you can deem them totally valueless even in the presence of their source. They're not needed there, but they're ultimately part of the emotion. In maybe a very subtle fashion, but to say that they have no presence whatsoever, it's difficult to say that. Since the words and the feelings have some type of relationship, because the words contain the feeling, the words express the feeling, so even though when you have the feeling, there's no need to express the feeling, because you have the feeling, like I spoke last week, but still we have to conclude that the letters have some value and existence, however subtly, even within the world of the emotion. But then there are other types of words. There are words that don't contain the emotion. Like the words in which you ponder how to implement the craving. Not the words in which you ponder the craving. The words in which you ponder how to implement the craving. These words, really, they mamish have no presence in the presence of the emotion. To continue the analogies that we were giving last week. You never saw that somebody should tell a spouse, you know, I truly cherish you, and I want to buy you a present in some large department store. So the spouse will ask, tell me, how do you spell the word cherish? You're smiling, but why are you smiling? Why? Is that an absurd question? The word cherish has a spelling. What's wrong with asking how do you spell it? And the answer is, of course it has a spelling, but it's totally irrelevant. It's meaningless. The spelling of cherish is out of place in this context. Now, this is even after the word was spoken. Certainly in the presence of the emotion, an emotion has a spelling, but it's irrelevant. But this is not it. Imagine something else. Imagine the spouse asks, not how you spell the word cherish. How do you spell the word department store? Not how do you spell the word cherish. How do you spell the word department store? You see how much more irrelevant these words are and how more absurd this is. At least cherish is a description of the emotion. But department store is a technical detail. It's totally disconnected from the very emotion. In the presence of the emotion, they truly have no identity whatsoever. The words cherish, the letters cherish in the presence of the emotion, don't have a status, don't have significance, don't have value. They're meaningless, they're irrelevant. But ultimately, they have some existence, even in the most subtle degree. But letters that don't even contain the emotion, and these are just technical letters that we employ into our psyche to contemplate and to ponder how to implement them, these truly have no identity in the presence of the emotion. So when the Alter Rebbe says that letters are born when you begin thinking about implementation, what he is doing, what he's telling us is, apparently he's referring to the type of letters that have no identity whatsoever in the presence of their progenitors. These letters are only born at a later stage. This is in the parable. How does this apply to our discussion? The metaphor of the words, and it's only a metaphor, that we spoke about last week and earlier, doesn't describe the true depth of the nothingness of the divine energy creating the universe when it's in the presence of its source in Hashem Himself. Because when we say that the world is a speech of Hashem, Hashem speaks and He creates a world, apparently we understand that to mean that the word contains, so to speak, Hashem's personality. It's a word that comes from His thought, a thought that comes from His emotions, an emotion that comes from His understanding and His awareness. So the word that creates the universe is a continuum, is a reflection of Hashem's personality. It's expressing Hashem. Even if we assume that, still we understand the doctrine of cosmic unity. We still understand that the world is really nothing, that the only reality is the intimate presence of Hashem. Because when a word is in the presence of its source, it has no name, it has no identity. When the word is in the presence of its source, the particular form of articulation through the vehicle of words doesn't have a significance, doesn't have an identity. But still you can say that it's totally nothing. What the Alter Rebbe wants to say is something much deeper. The word that sustains and creates the universe doesn't contain anything. It's just like those letters through which I ponder how to implement my craving. And this reveals to us a new depth in the nothingness of the universe. The 10 utterances through which Hashem created the world. Let there be light, let there be a firmament, let the earth sprout forth vegetation. Are not, the Alter Rebbe is saying, words and letters that express Hashem's personality. Let there be light is not an expression of Hashem, it's about doing something. And this is how Chassidus explains elsewhere. In Chabad discourses, they explain a very enigmatic medrash. The Pirkei de Rebbe Lezer writes, how did Hashem create the world? Natal ofer utzroidus v'zarkun umehem nasa olam. Hashem took sand and pebbles, and He threw them, and that's how the world came into being. What does this mean? What is the Pirkei de Rebbe Lezer trying to say? Zakt Chassidus like this. There are things through which there are activities through which humanity is expressed. Maybe a very low level of human achievement, but nonetheless humanity. For example, fixing a doorknob. The ability to fix a doorknob does not express the greatest achievement of humanity. It's not a piece of art, it's not a piece of music. But nevertheless, you're not going to request from your cat or your dog to fix your doorknob. They just can't do it. It's a manifestation of human achievement and human skill. But what about throwing pebbles? Is that something that's to be attributed to humanity? No, animals do that just as human beings, if not even better. There's no expression of humanity here. In the second chapter of Masechta Baba Kama, Perikates of the Regal, how does the second chapter begin? In Baba Kama, the Mishnah says, "Hayutzreidus menatzim etachas raglev v'shavras hakelim." If pebbles were shooting from under your animal's feet and she broke utensils through this way. So if I kick a pebble and you're standing on the other side of the field and the pebble comes flying into your face, you cannot identify in this act that a human being did it. You don't know who did it. It could be my animal was on the other side of the field and kicked the pebble. So the Medrash says, Hashem took pebbles and He threw them, and that's how the world came into being. What is the Medrash telling us? The divine word creating the universe is not a word that expresses him. It doesn't have anything of him inside of it. It's as though that if you examine the energy invested in the universe, you can't even identify him. It's like throwing a pebble. It's like me throwing a pebble. In the act, you can't identify the source. In the creative energy, creating the world, you have nothing, so to speak, of Hashem's intimacy expressed. That's how far this word is removed from him. So this gives us a whole new depth in understanding the nothingness of the word in the presence of Hashem. Since the word never left him, so Hashem's intimate presence is in the space of the word, and the word has no presence whatsoever. It doesn't even have the value of expressing him. When you view the world, you even view the divine energy in it. You can't recognize Hashem through it, the intimacy of Hashem through it. That's how insignificant and inconsequential this word is. So when this word is in the presence of his intimate self, it mamish has no value, it mamish has no presence. So you asked me, here we come to the next point, that this is so discouraging. This is so discouraging. What is the Alter Rebbe telling us? That the divine creative energy that creates us is considered nothing and naught and nothing, and it expresses nothing of Hashem, and especially based on what we're explaining now. That it's like me throwing a pebble. You can't even identify in the act me. There's nothing of my humanness that's expressed here. In the words that create the world, you have nothing of Hashem's inner personality, so to speak. Wow. So what does that tell us? On the contrary, not only this is not discouraging, this is probably one of the most healing and comforting pieces in the whole Chassidus. What is the Alter Rebbe saying? On the contrary, this is the most encouraging and healing and beautiful thing. The word never left him. This word that has no presence whatsoever never left the intimate of identity of Hashem. So what is this chapter of Tanya telling us? That at every single moment of my life and in every single space, I am totally one with Hashem's intimate self. Every event and every moment is a celebration of intimacy with Hashem. And in chapter 33, the Alter Rebbe will discuss at length the healing implications of this doctrine. But that's the point. The point is that this grants us the awesome awareness that there's nothing outside of him. And this redefines the essence of every moment of our life, of every experience of our life, of every move we make, of every word we utter. Everything has changed. The Alter Rebbe asks the question you asked in Likutei Torah, in his monumental work on Chumash, on Vayikra Bamidbar Dvarim, Likutei Torah, in the first discourse on Parshas Maaseh. The Alter Rebbe articulates in brief terms what he discusses here in Tanya, and then he says, and these are his words, "Ve'ein rei memusa yisrach hakus meitanu chas v'shalom." When we talk about this exaltedness, it doesn't mean that he's more remote from us and we're more distant from him. Ki adirabe shebazeh iskarvus etzleinu me'achar shahakol batel etzli yizbarach v'kamei kelei chashiv im kein ein hefsek. On the contrary, this makes him so much closer to us. Because since everything is nullified in his presence, so there is no hefsek, there is no separation between me and his intimate presence, which is right now here. If the word creating the universe had a presence, had a significance, had a value, there would be some type of separation. But since it's totally nullified, so the only thing that's here in my life at every single moment is the intimate presence of Hashem. That's the world. So in light of all this, we come to discover the main point Alter Rebbe wants to convey in these chapters, that reality has not changed as a result of the creation of the universe. So just as prior to creation, reality is defined as what? As Hashem. The definition of reality is Hashem. There's no other definition to reality. Now to post-creation, this has not changed. Because Kula, all of it, Kamei, in his presence is Kilai Chashev Mamish. It's as though it's really non-existent. It could be deemed as one big knot. And the only yes is the intimate reality of Hashem. There's me. There's a table, there's you, there's a mic, there's a whole world. Of course they exist. Nobody's going to say that there's no world. You ask me, that means there's no world? There's a world. It's opposite of Torah and opposite of Yiddishkeit to say there's no world. There is a world. Hashem created a world. What Alter Rebbe is saying is not there is no world. It's submerged, it's drowned in the all-pervading reality of Hashem. Like one word in the presence of this speaker. That's why the terminology that Alter Rebbe uses is what? Kula kamei keloi chashev. There's some people that, like I read sometimes, people write in the name of the Alter Rebbe that there's no world and it's an illusion. That's wrong. With all due respect, that's untrue. It's when you read Tanya, it's opposite to what the Alter Rebbe says in Tanya chapter 36, and Tanya chapter 23, and Tanya chapter 25 and 40, and many other places in Tanya, and countless places in his discourses. How people can say that in the name of the Alter Rebbe, I don't understand. It's not true. The Tzemach Tzedek, the grandson of the Alter Rebbe, the third Rebbe in the Chabad dynasty, writes in his Sefer Derech Mitzvah, he has a book, Derech Mitzvah. He explains that many of the mitzvahs according to Chassidus and in the mitzvah Hamanas Alakus, dealing with the faith of Hashem in the 8th chapter. Tzemach Tzedek says, when Chassidus talks about cosmic unity, it doesn't mean that the world only doesn't exist. And the Tzemach Tzedek says, if that's what it would mean, we would have to say, not Kula Kamei Kilei Chashev, we would have to say, Kula Kamei Loi Chashev, in His presence, it's not existing. Not Kilei. Kilei means it's as though it's not existing. Doesn't say loy chashev, it says kiloy chashev. It's as though it's not existing. And the Tzemach Tzedek brings another proof. You know what a second proof is? He says, kula kamei kiloy chashev includes the physical world. And we see that the physical world has stones and homes and sand and dust and plants, and animals, and human beings. So how can you say that it doesn't exist? Now, this is a very important thing that Tzemach Tzedek is saying. You know why you can't say there's no world? Tzemach Tzedek is saying, because I see a world. Chassidus is not based on fantasy. Chassidus is not based on illusion. Tzemach Tzedek is saying, if I see a world, it means there's a world. What I see is true. I see a world. You can't say there's no world. When I put on tefillin, I'm putting on tefillin. Tefillin exists. When Chassidus talks about the non-existence of existence, it doesn't mean literally there's no world. Chassidus is discussing the meaning of the world, the significance of the world. What is the content of the world? What is the soul of the world? What is the role the world plays, etc. Now we come to the next stage. I was asked the source of the terms Kula Kamei Kalei Chashev and Leis Asar Ponimine. Everything in his presence is as though non-existing and there's no space devoid of him. The term Leis Asar Ponimine, there's no space devoid of him in the beginning of this chapter, is from Zohar. As I mentioned, it's from Zohar. It's from Tikkuni Zohar, Tikkunun Zayin, and in other places in Zohar there are similar expressions. In one place in Zohar Chadash, in Parshas Yisroi, Daf Lamed Gimel, the Zohar compares Hashem to a soul which less aver ponui mino. There's no organ in the body that's devoid of the soul. Now it's interesting, in Medrash Rabbah, in Shmois Rabbah, in Parsha Beis, Piskei, the Medrash explains one of the reasons why Hashem revealed Himself to Moshe in a snare, in a thorn bush. To teach you that there's no space devoid of the Shechinah, of the Divine Presence, even a thorn bush. the term Kula Kamei Kalei Chashev, it's not the first time the Alter Rebbe mentions it here in Perek Chaf and Chaf Aleph. He mentioned it in chapter 3, in chapter 16, and last week in chapter 20. It's mentioned in most probably hundreds of Hasidic discourses of the Alter Rebbe. It's a foundation in his thought, in his philosophy, in his perspective. I mentioned in chapter 3, this is an expression from Zohar, which is the most fundamental book in Kabbalah, a few places in Zohar. The first place in Zohar where this term is mentioned, Kula Kamei Kalei Chashev, is in the introduction to Zohar, Daf Yud Aleph Amid Beis. In Zohar it says there, Kula Kamei Kalei Chashivin, all in his presence is as though non-existent, as though non-chashev, it has no value. The Zohar, actually, the word they use there is chashev, not kalei chashev. And that's paraphrasing a pasuk in Daniel. In Daniel, Perek Dalet, there's an expression, v'chol doireyara kalei chashevin. All inhabitants of the earth are reckoned as nothing in relation to Hashem. But in Reishis Chachma, one of the most important books in Jewish spirituality and ethics, in the beginning of Reishis Chachma, Shar Hayir, in the beginning of the first chapter, he quotes the Zohar, and his version is Kula Kamei Kalei Chashiv, not Chashivin, and Alter Rebbe uses that version also here in Tanya, and in, I think, all of his other discourses, where he uses this term. After this, we can understand the structure of this chapter. And there's a very heavy structure. The Alter Rebbe begins the chapter 21 by saying that in Hashem's case, the speech is not detached from the speaker, because ein davar chutz mimenu, there is nothing outside of him, and there's no space devoid of him. Right after that, Alter Rebbe adds, and this is a parenthetical addition that's not relevant to the actual thrust of the chapter. And in fact, in Mahadura Kama, in the first versions of the Tanya, I mentioned that before the Tanya was published, the Tanya was already copied in manuscript form from the original manuscripts of the Alter Rebbe, and then before the Alter Rebbe sent it to press, he re-edited it. So in the first versions of the Tanya, this piece is missing. From the words, Drachai Midarcheichem, he goes over to the words, but in the printed edition, he added a very important parenthetical addition. Namely, right away we have a question. If so, why is it called speech? If it doesn't leave him, it shouldn't be called speech. Speech signifies the fact that it leaves its speaker. So the Alter Rebbe right away explains that in addition to the separation element that characterizes speech, there is also another feature that characterizes speech, namely revelation. Now, by human beings, they work together. When I reveal something, it becomes separated from me. For me to reveal a thought, an emotion, it has to leave me. By Hashem, in his case, speaking means revealing, but it doesn't mean separation. So when we say that Hashem created through speech, it means that Hashem actualized something of his creative power through the creation of the universe. He reveals it. Through creation, there's actualization. There is a projection of Hashem's creative power. He actualizes something of himself through creating a world. But it doesn't leave him. It's actualized within him. This actualization occurs within his infinite presence. And as the Alter Rebbe explains in this chapter, this actualization within his infinite presence is quite meaningless, because the word within the emotion has no presence or value. But it is an actualization of some sort, and that's why we call it speech. Now here we should add that in chapter 22, the Alter Rebbe will add a whole new idea. Namely, that since from the world's perspective, the divine word is perceived as something separate from the speaker. So therefore, from their perspective, it's mamish like human speech. It's really like human speech, where one communicates a word to somebody else, and that word leaves him. So Hashem communicates His energy in a manner that the created realities of this energy perceive themselves to be outside of Him. But that's next week. Let's not jump ahead. That's chapter 22. Here He says that the truth is that the speech is one and submerged within the speaker, and thus in essence there's no reality outside of Him. Hashem is one. Now comes the next piece in the chapter. On the next Amid. Here comes the big question. We don't feel anything of this. The Alter Rebbe here redefines what reality is, redefines what's the meaning of cosmic unity, what's the meaning of Hashem as one. We feel ourselves as existences. That's the story of our life. That's the story of human history. So here the Alter Rebbe introduces a third point in chapter 21 in addition to the first two points. And the third point is that the change that occurs through creation is only a change that occurs from our vantage point. But it's not a real change. Because the word of Hashem that creates us doesn't come directly to us in its full intensity. It anyway needs to first be contracted and concealed, unlimited and constricted, so that it should be able to create finite creatures, limited creatures. And as a result of all of these constrictions, something else happens. And what is that something else? We perceive the speech as having left the speaker. Which means the limitations and compressions that this speech undergoes in order to create us as finite creatures also, as the Alter Rebbe says, Gamkein also creates another reality. It creates a perception that the speech left the speaker. The people that are created by the speech, or the creatures or their existences that are brought into being by that speech, feel that the speech has left Hashem. And since it left Hashem, it assumes an identity, it assumes a presence. If it assumes a presence, then we also have a presence, then we also have an identity. True, it doesn't have an egotistical presence, but it has a presence. That's how the Alter Rebbe explains elsewhere the etymology of the term in Hebrew for world. How do you say world in Hebrew? Olam. You know the source of that word? Concealment, helam in Parshas Vayikra, v'ne'elam davar meini hakol. Something is concealed from the eyes of the community. Helam means concealment, opaqueness. You know why? You know what the definition of a world is? A space, a perception of reality which is experiencing itself as an entity outside of Hashem's intimate presence. That's why you say it's a world. If you would perceive the truth, you wouldn't call anything a world. What type of world? There's no world. There's Hashem's intimate self. The very fact you talk about a world, you're talking about something that has an identity, you can talk about it, you can discuss it, means there is a concealment. Because such a perception is possible only as a result of Hashem concealing Himself. A world means there is some level of self-consciousness. And any experience of self-consciousness can come about only by Hashem concealing Himself through the Tzimtzum, and thus not allowing the world to perceive His intimate presence in the space of the speech, and therefore there is a self. So the reality of a world, even the highest spiritual world, is dependent upon Hashem hiding His face. Allowing these realities to sense that the speech is not submerged within the speaker. So the creative energy creating them has an identity. So they have an identity. The moment we come to realize that we're not hiding from Him and He's not hiding from us, there's no world. Then the Alter Rebbe continues with step four, the final step of the chapter. That all this is only from our perspective. These tzimtzumim, these concealments can only impact and distort our view of truth. But relative to Hashem, from Hashem's point of view, all of these tzimtzumim, all of these veils have no meaning. Why? Because these veils are constructed from Him Himself. the concealments that Hashem constructs to conceal His energy, those concealments themselves are godly, so they can't cover up for from His. They can't cover up for Him. They don't constitute a covering for Him. They constitute a covering for us, not for Him. So from His point of view, it's as though the Tzimtzum doesn't exist, and thus the world is totally nullified, and the only reality is Hashem. And here the Alter Rebbe quotes a term of the Medrash, as I mentioned, Kahadein Kamtza de Levushe Minei Obey. It's like the Kamtza's garment, its shell, is part of its body. And let's discuss this Medrash for a few moments. Again, it's a very fundamental doctrine here. The Medrash is in Bereishis Rabbah, in Parshas Bereishis, Parsha Chafal of Piskehei. The Medrash discusses the Pasuk in Bereishis Peri Gimel, that after the Chet, after the sin of the Tree of Knowledge, Hashem made for Adam and his wife kosnos urvay al bishem. He made garments of skin and He dressed them. And Hashem said, "Hein ha Adam haya ka'achad mimenu." Behold, man has become like the unique one among us. Now, what does that mean? He has become like the unique one among us. There are various interpretations in the Medrash. One of the interpretations of the Rabbanan is that Adam became like Gavriel. Adam was like Gavriel. Concerning Gavriel, the Pasuk says in Daniel Perik Yud, Vihine ish echad levush habadim. Zog de medrash kahadein kamsa de levushe mineyu bay. What does this mean? In Daniel, in the 10th chapter of Daniel, he describes a vision he had near the Chidekel River, near the Tigris River. I raised my eyes and I saw, behold, one man clothed in linen. Vihine ish echad levush habadim, one man clothed in linen. Now, the commentators explain that in Yecheskel lived around 70 years before Daniel. In chapter 9, there's also a vision about the man dressed in linen. Now, how can you give a sign of a man dressed in linen? People change their garments, especially after 70 years. So this is what the Medrash says, that this man had a garment which was part of his body, like a kamtza, which his garment is part of its body, and therefore you can always give that as an identification feature, because it never changes. So the Medrash is saying that before the sin of the Tree of Knowledge, Adam was like Gavriel in the sense that his garment was part of his body and he didn't need artificial garments to dress, to cover his body. That's what it means. Hein ha Adam haya ka'achad mimenu. Man used to be like the ish echad, like the echad, like that one unique man who was dressed in linen Gavriel. And then after the sin, he needed special garments to cover his body. And the example for this in Medrash is the kamtza. What is a kamtza? So, there are various interpretations. I mentioned before what we usually translate. The Matnes Kahuna brings two interpretations in Medrash there. One interpretation is a kamtza is a min sheretz, a crawling small creature. Another interpretation is that it's a chagav, it's a locust or a grasshopper. In Parsha Shlach, on the Pasuk, when the Miraglim say in Parsha Shlach, Vanihi beineinu kachagavim, in our eyes, we viewed ourselves as grasshoppers. The Targum writes, Vahavina be'enei nafshana kekamtzin. So we see, according to the Targum, a kamtza is locust. Anyway, the Matnas Kuna says, whatever it is, it's a creature whose garment grows with it. Rashi in Shabbos, Daf Ayin Zion, brings two interpretations for the word kamtza brought in Gemara there. One is locust and one is an ant. Usually we interpret kamtza as a turtle or a snail. They both have a shell, but the shell is part of them. Now that coincides with the interpretation that kamtza is a sheretz, because in Parsha Shmini, both a turtle and a snail are enumerated as one of the eight shrotzim, the eight small crawling creatures described in Shmini. Tzav is the term many commentators identify the tzav as a turtle. And in the next pasuk you have the chaymet, which according to most opinions is the snail. So if we say that a kamtza is a sheretz, it's very logical to assume that it's either the turtle or the snail. It's interesting, the Rama, Reb Moshe Iserlish, in his book, Toiras Ha'oil, in the third section, Perik INA, quotes this Medrash, and his version is different. Not Kahadein kam to the Levushim in Eubay, but Kahi Chumta the Levushim in Eubay. Chumta is a chaymet, is a snail. In any case, the point is that these concealments, these veils that Hashem employed, are part of Him. So they don't constitute a concealment for Hashem, only for us, not for Hashem. Now, it's interesting that in other Hasidic discourses, it's discussed that this concept is expressed in Halacha. The Halacha in Shulchan Aruch and Erech Chaim and Siman Tzadik Aleph is that during davening you have to cover your head and you can't cover your head with your arm. Why? Because it's part of you. You can cover your head with a yarmulke, with a hat, with a piece of cloth, or even somebody else can cover your head with his hand, but not with your hand. The Marshal disagrees. The Marshal is lenient. He says you could, but this is the halacha. Why? So the commentators explain, the Be'er Hetiv says, and the Alter Rebbe writes it in Shulchan Aruch, in his own Shulchan Aruch, in Hilchas Tefillah, because your hand and your head are part of one body, and the body can't cover itself. The self can't cover the self. And this is true in the world of Allah, and it's true in the world of Kabbalah and Chassidus. Since the veil is godly, it can't conceal God. The veil is godly, so it can't cover Hashem. My hand can't cover my body. My hand can't cover my head. Because we're both part of the same body. So a godly veil can't really cover God. So it's not a real tzimtzum. So from our perspective, it's concealing, but really it's translucent and it conceals nothing. A godly tzimtzum doesn't conceal God. So the word never left the speaker. So the only reality is the intimate reality of Hashem. So this is what we might call the Hasidic theory of relativity, where we have to appreciate the difference between how the Word, the Divine Word, is seen from our perspective, from the world's perspective, and how it's viewed from Hashem's perspective. And in this case, Hashem's perspective, the one of the speaker, is the true one, because ours is distorted by a mask that is not really a mask, that is not really covering anything. So in summation, in the ultimate scheme of things, the Alter Rebbe says, we do not in truth constitute something that should be called an existence. The word existence, as applied to Hashem's absolute and unequivocal being, and the word existence as applied to our subjective sense of reality, have nothing in common other than their spelling. Before his passing, the holy Kuznets of Magid told his son, I'm not living in a body anymore. I'm a soul without a body. So the son grabbed his dying father's arm and he said, Tata, father, I feel your body. And the holy Kuznets of Magid said, the tapst mit gif, filst du gif. You grab me with a body, so you feel a body. In other words, the tools of our perception are impacted by the tzimtzum. So we touch ourselves and we feel a body. We touch ourselves and we feel an ego. But what's the truth? The truth is, what is reality? What is the reality of my body at this moment of our body? Reality is the oneness of Hashem. Reality is that hu levadei hu, that He is one alone. That is reality. One of the chassidim of the Alter Rebbe once entered the Alter Rebbe's study. And as he entered the study, the Alter Rebbe turned to him and asked him the following question. Was is der Eibishter? What is God? The chassid was silent. What is God? Was is der Eibishter? The Alter Rebbe again demanded. The chassid is silent. He's terrified. He's trembling. Alter Rebbe repeated his question several times and finally turns to the chassid. He says, why don't you answer me? The chassid looks at the Rebbe and he says, Rebbe, weil ich weiß nicht, because I don't know. I don't know what God is. So the Alter Rebbe cried. He says, und ich weiß, yeah. And I do know. But this I can say, the Alter Rebbe said. He exists absolutely, and aside of him, there is no true existence. Have a wonderful week.
Rabbi Jacobson delivers this weekly class on the Tanya at Heichal Menachem in the Borough Park section of Brooklyn, New York. To order additional tapes or albums, please call Heichal Menachem at 718-633-1076.